Here at Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, contact tracing is a big part of getting the novel coronavirus under control, but there are some misconceptions out there about how it actually works. We'll talk to a public health expert about what it involves and what to expect if we get a call from a contact tracer. First, political news stories and the arguments that follow them feel like they're just about everywhere these days. That may be especially true for kids and teenagers who spend a lot of time on social media. Political memes circulate on popular apps like TikTok, and even Snapchat has political channels. Young people have also been a key part of in-person activism, taking part in demonstrations about racial justice, climate change, and gun reform. With so much political content and emotion to absorb, what's the psychological impact on kids? And is there a health balance between being engaged in the news and taking some time to get away from the stress and just be a kid? Benjamin Oosterhoff is an assistant professor of psychology at Montana State University. His research focuses on adolescent political development, health, and well-being. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, Ben, I know you've been looking at these issues since before 2020, but given everything that's going on in 2020, is this an even bigger and more important issue when it comes to kids and the politics they see?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. You know, I don't know if I can say if it's bigger or more important, but I can certainly say that it's different. We find ourselves in a very different political climate and atmosphere than ever before. And that's certainly going to affect the way that kids are responding to politics, as well as adults, too.
Yeah, I know a lot of adults feel like they see a lot of news, maybe sometimes too much news. Is that something that's been happening for kids? Are they more exposed to current events than we might think they are?
Yeah, I think that I think they are more exposed than we think they are. I'm not sure if they're more exposed than they have been in the past. You know, I know it's really hard to always judge what other people are experiencing within their own social bubbles, and comparing that with, you know, how things have been trending over the last, you know, 40 years or whatever it might be. And so it's kind of a tricky question to ask. But I think one thing that I would like to pose is, we can think about, well, how much do we expect kids to be paying attention to politics? If I were to ask, you know, how many kids between the ages of 11 and 15 would you expect to have at least some level of political interest? You know, that's a question we can ask, you know, on the show, actually. If I posed that question, what would you think?
I don't know. I mean, I have kids that are a little bit older than that, and they're kind of interested. 30-40%. I'll just make up some numbers. That's my guess.
Yeah, that's a great guess. So we have some data coming from an entire middle school. So we surveyed the entire middle school. We don't have a selection bias of who participated. And 55% of middle schoolers are at least a little bit interested in politics right now.
Now, let's talk about the kind of politics. By a lot of measures, our politics are really polarized right now, and people are kind of angry at either end of things. Does that have an effect on kids for better or worse?
Yeah. So that's actually a question that we're digging into currently. We've been interested more in how kids experience politics from an emotional side and what those emotions mean for the way that they engage moving forward and what it means for their mental health. We find that kids endorse a wide variety of different costs related to being engaged in politics. Several kids say that they're stressed out. Politics makes them sad. Politics are disrupting their friendships. They're disrupting their relationships with their parents and extended family members. Politics are resulting in some extreme cases in legal costs for some young people. And so the polarized climate that we have right now definitely comes with a toll to it. I think one thing that we didn't expect, though, in doing this research is that it's also accompanied by a very, very wide variety of benefits. Kids who are politically active are doing it for a reason. They're doing it because it provides them with an avenue to connect with other kids, to connect with broader social groups, to make them feel empowered. Politics gives kids a great sense of purpose and meaning in what they're doing, and it increases their confidence that they can actually contribute to social change.
We're talking to Benjamin Oosterhoff from Montana State University. He's a psychology professor. He studies political development, among other things, among kids and adolescents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are younger, whatever range you want to define that, are you paying close attention to the politics? How does that make you feel? If you're a parent, how do you talk about politics with your kids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ben, let's talk about that point. Do you have thoughts on how families can have, you know, positive, productive conversations with kids about politics that, you know, that boosts that interest in civic engagement without hopefully stressing kids out too much?
Yeah, political discussions, I really cannot underemphasize the importance of them, especially within the family. One of the best predictors of whether or not young people will go on to vote, whether they'll go on to be interested in politics and engage in other avenues, is whether or not they grew up with political discussions in their home. And now, more than ever, that feels like a very challenging thing for people to do. And usually what I recommend when people have that question is, before entering into a political conversation with your kids, take a moment and reflect on what the goals of that conversation are going to be for you. You know, are you thinking that you want to have a political conversation because you want to see where your kids are at on certain issues? Are you really, really motivated to make sure that they have a specific viewpoint? Or are you just curious? Are you giving them a platform to share their ideas? Usually we find that the latter approach, you know, using it as a way for just kids to express what they're thinking and what they're feeling, is connected with a lot of benefits, where the former approach, going into it thinking, I need to make sure my kid has this specific viewpoint, is not so great.
I saw an interesting... Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I saw an interesting point while I was reading up on this from a Republican politician who said what he did with his kids was steer clear of the really controversial national stuff at first and try to look at how the local things that have a direct impact on kids' lives play out politically, like the local school board, the local government, as a good entry point into civic engagement. What do you think about that approach?
Yeah, I think that has a lot of merit to it. You know, usually it's a little bit easier for young people to begin with grasping examples and in grasping issues related to their more local community, with their school board, with, you know, their community, their larger community, decisions about whether to put in a park at a specific location. It can be a great way of kind of introducing them to those concepts. And then as they grow older and become a part of other communities, whether, you know, they move or they go to college or whatever it might be, they can kind of begin again there. I would add one caveat to that, though, and I would say I would be wary of shying away from topics your teens or your children want to talk about. If you do have a child who is interested and shows that they want to talk about the harder issues, I wouldn't shy away from them. I also wouldn't force that on them if you feel like they're not ready.
Now, what about when the political issues and news are really scary? Like my parents' generation had nuclear war. My generation had nuclear war and serial killers. Kids today fear of how climate change will impact their lives and school shootings. How about that really scary stuff? How do we talk about ways that don't just frighten them and make them maybe turn to despair?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, kids are paying attention to these things, whether or not we talk about it directly or not. So I think one thing to always keep in mind is that even if you're not having a conversation about this, they're getting this information, you know, from social media. They're getting it from their friends. You know, we have data that shows two out of three kids are talking to their friends about politics on a very regular basis, even in middle school. With that frame in mind, I think as long as you approach the conversation with a lot of empathy, sympathy, and perspective taking, so kind of meeting the child where they're at, you can kind of get a better understanding of, are they already really scared about these things? You know, do I need to serve as more of a safe haven to reassure them that, you know, they'll be all right? Are there ways to channel that fear into productive avenues of giving back? You know, that the feelings that come with contributing to fixing the problem do a lot of good to combat anxiety around those problems. And that's a great way parents can kind of help in those situations. But I think starting off, it's really important for us to go into these conversations with very, very few assumptions about where kids are at themselves.
We're talking to Ben Oosterhoff, developmental psychologist from Montana State University. We're talking about the impact that political news can have on kids and teenagers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a teenager yourself, do you feel like you're bombarded by political news? Is it part of your social media mix with your friends and the people you follow? Do you like engaging with politics? Do you feel burnt out? Parents, have you noticed kids paying more attention to politics than you did maybe at their age? Are you glad to see it? Do you worry about how it could affect their mental well-being? And how about the conversations around the dinner table or wherever? How do you talk about politics in your family? Do you talk about politics in your family with your kids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Ben Oosterhoff, assistant professor of psychology at Montana State University, looking at the effect that political news and debate can have on young people's mental well-being. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Parents, do you see your kids, whatever age they might be, being tuned into politics, maybe more so or less so than you remember being at their age? Do you like to see them engaged in the news? Do you worry about the stress it causes? How do you talk about issues of politics with your younger children, with your teenagers, whatever the case may be, if you are one of the teenagers yourself? Love to hear from you. Do you feel like you see a lot, too much, not enough? Are you politically active yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ben, let's talk about that. Young people, a big part of political activism at various stages in American history. The Freedom Riders and the sit-ins at diners and places like that, a lot of young people. And today, a lot of young people involved in various forms of protest activity. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head. There are numerous instances where we can consider young people kind of on the forefront of social change. And I think that part of that is because young people are learning more about what the system is and forming ideas about what the system should be without being as deeply embedded within it quite yet. I think it's really interesting to take a step back and think about why young people would be gravitated towards that as much as they are. Part of it, I think, has a lot to do with considering that there are a variety of issues that that greatly affect young people, even to a greater extent than adults. When you think about issues concerning education, climate change, voting rights to some degree, there are a lot of instances where we can think about how those issues might have greater consequences for younger people than adults. And so young people can't vote in many instances until they're 18. There are some legal barriers there. And so protesting can be one way of expressing their views on those issues that they have access to.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in Greendale. Mary, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call. We presently have a 14-year-old who is the last of six children. And with her ideas, with her social media involvement, with everything going on, of course, the presidency, the whole social kind of, you know, platforms that the kids are on and everything, politics does come up. And I guess I've always kind of felt like the office of the president is, well, it used to be in the past, something that should be respected. But there are so many things going on right now that there's no way that we can sit and tell our daughter to respect the person in that office with so much of what we see. And with all the fact-checking and everything going on, there's so much lying going on and manipulating and things like that. So I'm just wondering what your guest there is, you know, telling us as far as I want her to respect the presidency, but I don't see a lot of lesson learning when it comes to her in the current status of what's going on in the office right now.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Separating the presidency from a particular president that Mary is not a fan of, Ben.
Yeah, Mary, thank you. That was a very great question. So I think one thing that you can do and one thing that you really have to offer to your daughter is that you have a historical perspective on what political engagement and what the presidency, you know, means to you that your daughter might not have quite yet. So it's always important to think about that young people in many cases are experiencing politics for the very first time. And so this is providing them with a frame of reference that they might carry forward, but they don't have the frame of reference moving back. And so in a lot of ways, the way that you described your question, I feel like would be a very interesting and productive conversation to have with your daughter and to say, you know, this is what I'm worried about. Like, what are your ideas about this? Like, how do you feel about this? And it's important to always recognize that it hasn't always been this way. And I think if you keep it in a very inquisitive way, asking a lot of questions, but then also couching it in that historical kind of view, I think that would be really well received.
Mary, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Jeff now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you for this topic. As a kid growing up in South Superior in Butler Park, all the ladies in the neighborhood cared about the other kids as if they were their own. There was a group of about, I'm going to say, 10 to 12 mothers. We all had a bunch of kids around the same age, and we all grew up together. In the election of 1972, some women, some mothers supported Nixon, and some mothers supported McGovern. I know because my mother had a McGovern neighborhood headquarter kind of thing. But the thing is, the women cared about their kids as though they were their own. The political differences didn't matter because it came to about creating a neighborhood and caring for each other because we're all Americans. I just think that can happen today, too.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. That idea about being part of the same community and conveying that idea to kids, even when there are political disagreements, sounds harder now than maybe it used to be. I don't know, Ben.
Yeah, I think it might be. I think that it's, I think that with the way that we consume political information and with how polarized everything is right now, it's hard to escape it. And it's hard to feel like politics aren't relevant, even in instances where they shouldn't be relevant, such as, you know, just providing basic care for your kids and your kids in your neighborhood. And that's a challenge. That's a challenge that we're going to have to figure out as a culture moving forward. Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer for that one yet, but I do think it's a great observation.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about kids and teenagers being exposed to politics, the effect that can have on them, maybe anxiety, the positive sides of it, and how to talk about it in families. Benjamin Oosterhoff is with us from Montana State University, assistant professor of psychology there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ben, we've touched on this a little bit, but the idea that, okay, if an adult is concerned about politics, they know that at least on election day, they can vote. And as you mentioned, with the voting age, most kids can't. Can that be a frustrating experience for them, not having that outlet?
I think so. I mean, a lot of our work has shown that kids would like to vote. If, you know, most young people support changing the voting age to 16, and a big part because they feel like there are issues that disproportionately affect them, that they would like to have a say in. And, you know, right now I can 100% sympathize with that take on it. That being said, I do think young people are finding very creative ways for getting involved in politics, even in the absence of voting, whether it is through social media and having conversations with people around the country or around the world about political issues, joining different groups electronically, and participating in new forms of activism, like we saw with TikTok recently. And so I think that kids are being creative about the problem. But ultimately, it will continue to go back to them wanting the ability to express their opinions in a more formal way. And that's another thing adults can do to help is just listen to kids' political attitudes, because they certainly have them.
On that thought, Carol from Madison called, couldn't stay on the air, but she said maybe we should expand the frame to include civic engagement. And Carol wonders, what would you say to something like extending voting rights for 16 or 17-year-olds to vote in things like municipal and school board elections? So that, again, that local political involvement and maybe a chance to vote at the local level, Ben.
Yeah, I'm a firm advocate for expanding voting rights for young people. There are many municipalities around the United States right now that currently allow 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds to vote in them. Tacoma Park, Berkeley, California allows 16-year-olds to vote in school board elections. Oregon is voting on changing the voting age in this election. So far, the science behind that decision supports the, you know, there's no developmental reason why we shouldn't allow younger people to be more active in voting. And I think starting on a smaller scale is very a practical way of approaching that problem. And so, yes, I'm 100% behind that.
In our last minute or so, Ben, I know a problem for us grownups is often we might live in neighborhoods with like-minded people. We can very easily find online communities with people who agree with us. Do you see that as a potential pitfall for teens, that they end up, stumbling into that one point of view and not running into other points of view?
Yeah, I think that it's something that we should keep our eyes on. One thing that I think that we have going for us, especially for young people and exposure to kind of political diversity, is that young people are going to get more politically diverse conversations in classrooms. And that's something that kind of fades away as we get older. But classrooms are one place where you might expect to see greater exposure to different viewpoints. Even out of school activities like clubs, you may see some exposure to diverse viewpoints, more so than when you kind of have a little bit more autonomy in selecting who you spend time with. You know, kids can't usually pick who their classmates are, but when you're an adult, you can predict, pick who your friends are and who you're going to spend time with. So although it's something I think we need to monitor, there are some structures in place that help preserve a little bit of diversity.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Benjamin Oosterhoff is an assistant professor of psychology at Montana State University, focusing on adolescent political development and well-being. We talked to them about how young people are impacted by political news and the disagreements that can come along with it. You can still share your thoughts, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a public health doctor about what contact tracers actually do and why they're a key part of the response to the coronavirus outbreak. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, to parboil or not to parboil? That is the question, at least when you're grilling brats. We'll find out what science says about the eternal Wisconsin grilling debate. First, testing has gotten a lot of attention during the COVID-19 pandemic as a tool to understand the scope of the disease. But another piece of the puzzle, contact tracing, is another big part of the effort to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus. There are some misconceptions out there about what contact tracers do, and even conspiracy theories about the job have sprung up online. Our next guest joins us to tell us what it actually involves and what to expect if we get a call from a contact tracer. Dr. Crystal Watson is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and assistant professor of environmental health and engineering at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Watson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk first about the importance of contact tracing as an element in getting the spread of COVID-19 under control?
Yeah, contact tracing really is our best tool in controlling the spread of this virus in an ongoing way. The other tool we have is these broad-based social distancing measures like the stay-at-home orders and the business restrictions that we've seen that have been in place. But once we lift those, we really need something to manage this on a case-by-case basis, and that is contact tracing. It helps us break chains of transmission and control the virus over time.
And contact tracing isn't new with COVID-19, right? Can you talk about some of the history?
Yeah, contact tracing is really a core tool of public health. It's been in use for decades and decades for different types of diseases like sexually transmitted infections, and even Ebola, it was used both in the U.S. and in West Africa to control Ebola there. And it's also been put to use in the latest Ebola outbreak in the DRC.
It seems like in some ways contact tracing is going to be both harder and more important because of the way this coronavirus is spreading, the thing where if I get it but I don't have symptoms yet, or ever, I guess, I can still spread this thing even though I don't look like a COVID-19 patient. Talk about how that affects contact tracing.
That's right. Contact tracing isn't a perfect tool. It's a tough job even at the best of times and with other diseases that we're more practiced with. But COVID-19, as you said, can spread asymptomatically. And so what's really important with contact tracing in this case is that once we get in touch with contacts with public health officials, then we ask those contacts to quarantine at home for 14 days if they had a significant contact with a case. And what that does is if they become infectious, and even if they don't have symptoms and they're at home and they're not spreading it to other people out in the community, that's the idea.
Let's talk about the nuts and bolts of what a contact tracer does. First of all, that conversation with the person who has a diagnosed positive case of COVID-19, what is that conversation like? What kind of things does the contact tracer want to find out?
Yeah, so first they want to check in on a person who's sick with COVID-19. Obviously, this disease looks different for different people, but people can be severely affected. So we want to make sure they're doing okay, that they have the resources they need to isolate at home, or if they need to have additional medical care, connect them with that care. So a lot of questions about how they're doing and what was the course of their illness, as well as where they think they were infected. Then they want to ask about what contacts that person may have had during the time they are infectious. And that's about 2 days before they developed symptoms, if they did get symptoms, up until the time they isolated at home. And so by understanding who they were in contact with, and we were interested in close contacts, so that's people they were in direct contact with, that means within 6 feet of that other person for more than 15 minutes, then we can start contacting those other people who may have been infected.
Let's go to that follow-up conversation now. Somebody else had the disease. They say, yeah, I was hanging out with Rob for a half an hour in that time range. What's that conversation going to look like from my end?
Yeah, so if you're Rob, a contact tracer will be in touch with you, say that you may have had a significant exposure to someone with COVID-19. They won't reveal who that person was. They'll keep that identity private. But then also tell that person that they should quarantine for 14 days in order to avoid exposing other people if they are infected. But also asking them if they have the resources to do that, asking if they need anything like food or medicines or other support, maybe for family members in the household. And even for some people, if they can't quarantine at home safely, say they have an elderly relative at home, then maybe even offering them a place like a hotel to safely quarantine during that time.
Talking to Dr. Crystal Watson from Johns Hopkins, looking at contact tracing during COVID-19. Dr. Watson, there's a lot of negative rumors going around about contact tracing. Some of it's pretty out there conspiracy theories, but I think some people are generally concerned and maybe confused about a few points. One is, if you're talking to me and I'm giving out the names of my friends and family members, am I putting them at risk of, being quarantined or getting some kind of negative treatment?
Yeah, so public health is very practiced at keeping this information private and acting responsibly with the information they get from contact tracing. But in order to protect one another, we do have to take these measures to try and prevent the spread. So if you do share names, it may be that that person will be asked to quarantine. But what public health won't do is share their information with other agencies of government or sell that information. They will keep it private, and it's for the use for epidemiology and for understanding the spread of the virus as well as keeping individuals safe.
Are there other misconceptions you run into when it comes to contact tracing that you want to, reassure people about?
Yeah, first of all, self-isolation and self-quarantine is entirely voluntary in this country, and with the exception of some very, very outside cases. So really, no one's forcing people to go into quarantine in a facility or anything like that. Really, we're just counting on individuals to act responsibly and to stay at home in order to protect themselves and others.
Let's talk about resources. Do we have enough contact tracers doing this job right now?
Unfortunately, we don't have enough contact tracers. Even in the locations that have put considerable resources into contact tracing, as we see case numbers rise, we're also going to need additional contact tracers, because you can imagine for every case, I think the average across the country is something like 8 to 10 contacts. So for every case generating 8 to 10 contacts, that's a lot of work for one individual to follow up on. So there are other locations in the country that haven't put those same types of resources into developing the workforce. So I think on average across the country, we still have quite a ways to go to meet the need in this unfolding epidemic.
There's been talk about cuts in public health funding over the last years, decades, I guess. Is there a case to be made to have a better workforce in public health all the time, so we're not trying to spin it up really fast in a crisis like this?
Yeah, this initiative to scale up the contact tracing workforce is really unprecedented in this country, but we would be at a much better place if we had sufficiently resourced health departments at the state and local, tribal, and territorial level in this country. And so where we started out at the beginning of COVID-19 was we had about 2,200 contact tracers identified around the country. What we need is something on the order of 100,000 across the country. And so I do think there's a clear case for more dedicated funding annually, not just in emergencies.
Can you point towards success stories, maybe in other countries, on COVID-19 and contact tracing?
Yeah, there are some really great success stories in other countries, places like New Zealand, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Iceland. They have all employed a number of public health measures, but one key one is contact tracing. And in many of those places, they've brought transmission of COVID-19 down to really low levels. And in some cases, in the case of New Zealand, for example, virtually eliminated the virus from their population. Now, they're in a very different situation than we are in this country right now. But I do think once we have epidemics somewhat under control in this country, we can greatly reduce transmission and make it much more safe to go back out in society and do our jobs and get back to a little bit more sense of normalcy.
That's a good point for our last minute or so. If we do better on testing plus contact tracing plus voluntary isolation, does that make it easier to do things like open schools back up?
Absolutely. I think there is a way to open schools safely, but the prerequisite for that really is we have to have control of a local epidemic. We can't have this large reservoir of uncontrolled spread. Otherwise, it will burn through schools. It will make teachers and staff members very sick. And so we need to be able to prevent the introduction into school settings. And that's how we do it, is we really get control through testing, case identification, contact tracing, and quarantine.
Dr. Watson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Crystal Watson is Assistant Professor of Environmental Health and Engineering at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She joined us to talk about how contact tracing works and why it's a big part of slowing the spread of COVID-19. Coming up, science shows that boiling doesn't necessarily give us the best brat. A food writer reveals what he discovered when he put brat straight on the grill, no pre-boiling involved. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll look at the politics of the $600 supplemental unemployment benefits and whether they should be extended. Now take fresh brats, boil them, maybe with some beer involved, and then toss them on the grill. That's the Wisconsin way for many, but not all grillers. Our next guest says that science shows boiling doesn't necessarily give us the best brat. Daniel Higgins is the food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Northeast Wisconsin. He recently talked about his research with WPR host Keely Boltina.
You are playing with a bit of fire here, Dan. Pun sort of intended. I mean, what gave you the gall to take on the idea of whether you should boil brats?
Well, I know it's always been a somewhat fun, serious conversation or debate among grillers. And I thought, well, I wonder if there's anything happening at the molecular level, so to speak, and got in touch with a professor down there at UW-Madison who was able to walk me through what's going on with bratwurst as you cook them.
So that associate professor in the meat and science department at UW-Madison talked with you, walked you through it. So walk us through it. What is happening? Yes or no to boiling?
Well, scientifically speaking, no. What's happening is in the bratwurst, there's proteins, and as you cook them, they in essence open up. You know, so think of it like if you put a bunch of ingredients in a salad, they're all kind of separate, and they're not really bound together at all. So that's kind of what's in there. You know, the spices, there's fat, there's all this other stuff. And what happens is as you heat up the bratwurst, that those proteins kind of open up. Also, what was happening is the casein is shrinking a little bit. It also has proteins in it because it's a meat product as well. It's, you know, the slower they open up, the more time they have to bind with the seasonings, the fat, and then also with the casein itself. So that's what, you know, when you bite into a bratwurst and there's that kind of snap, that's what's happened is they've kind of, the proteins in the meat and the casein have bound together. They've kind of all come together. I mean, it's like when you cook anything, there's always something going on at that level, right? I mean, you put cake batter in pans, you put it in the oven, and it comes out in a different texture, different form, the flavor even changes a little bit too. So what happens with the brats are in the water or the boiling beer at this point, it can kind of end up with that rubbery kind of feeling to the casein, and the meat itself can end up kind of being a little bit mushy compared to if you're going with a low and slow method in the drier heat of like a grill.
But I thought boiling things offered that consistent heat all around for better cooking.
Yes. I mean, and for most things it does, right? I mean, that's exactly the benefit of and you mentioned that too, is that's one of the benefits of cooking in that, but not everything works best that way. And this is one of those cases where you want something to open up a little bit slower.
You mentioned other factors that can affect the brat in the end, the taste and the texture. What are those? It's not just boiling or I guess cooking method.
Right. I mean, if you start off with an inferior brat, it doesn't matter which method you use, you know, so it's the quality of meat they're using, obviously, the types of seasoning that's being added into the bratwurst as well, which tends to be, you know, like salt, pepper, and then there's like a certain scent of other seasonings that tend to be kind of typical. And those, so what they're using, the quality of all those ingredients are going to come into play, but also the grind of the meat itself. I mean, if you look inside the bratwurst or if you compare two bratwurst next to each other, you'll notice that the little chunks of ground up meat are going to be different sizes. The larger the pieces, the more immediate hit you're going to get up right up front on the flavor. Like all that brat flavor is going to hit real quick and then kind of fade away as the more you chew. Whereas the finer, if a brat maker goes with a finer grind, the more you chew, the more the flavor will come out. Yeah, there's just different factors, and they're, like I said, everybody's going to have their own secret blend of spices that they put into their bratwurst that they obviously feel like are better than everybody else's.
Dan Higgins writes about food and drink. He's a reporter based in Northeast Wisconsin, and we're talking about what science says about parboiling brats and whether that information should change the way we cook out. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Dan, you put this idea of skipping the boil to the test. What was your method?
Just the method that's right on Johnsonville's package, they tell you, just put it right on there. So, yeah, I just went with the low and slow over the heat and just kind of kept turning them and just watched for them to be done right at the end until they, you know, look golden brown and were nice and plump. So,
You did try two different kinds of brats too, right?
Yeah, I
I did it with two of the fresh bratwursts, which are widely available in Wisconsin. Johnstone and Clements are probably the most dominant around. I looked a little bit for Usinger's, but I think outside the Milwaukee area, it's kind of a little bit more hit and miss of finding their fresh bratwursts. I was a little surprised that really we're down to two main fresh bratwursts. I mean, there's a lot of pre-cooked ones, but that's a whole different article somewhere down the line. So, and really the Johnsonville and the Clements are really, or is it Clements? It really two different approaches. Clements is really much more that European German, a little bit finer grind. The seasoning's more along those way. And the Johnsonville is kind of that Sheboygan, Wisconsin style bratwurst that's, you know, a little bit coarser grind and that bigger hit up front. So really both, if you have those bratwurst side by side, you kind of get a good sense of how that grind can really affect, and grind and seasoning affects the flavor difference between the two.
Did you find that your cooking method, gas grill, no boil ahead of time, made a difference?
I've been non-parboiling for a while. That's just how I've come to accept that. That's been a longstanding thing of mine too. Is like I've always been longer on the no parboil side of things for quite some time. So maybe I had a little bias going into the story.
Speaking of that,
but yeah, you get that nice snap on there, and you get to do a lot of turning of the bratwurst, which is, you know, come on, that's the fun of grilling, is flipping stuff around. Who wants to just put something on there and just kind of wait, right? I mean, put something on the grill so you can stand there, double-click your tongs, and flip things around.
Thank you for the acknowledgement of the double-clicking the tongs, because so much of what you write about feels authentic to that grilling experience. I mean, who doesn't do that? Isn't that part of the game, right? You click the tongs.
Mm-hmm. Right, or, you know, enjoying a cocktail or a beer while you're grilling, too. I mean, that's just all part of it, right? And back when we used to be able to all get together for big parties, you know, being the grill master and being able to ask someone to go get you a beer. I mean, how doesn't that feel great, right?
Yeah, we'll get back to those times soon, but probably not anytime soon. We'll get back to soon.
Maybe next summer.
Right. What makes a typical Wisconsin brat different than other places? What makes us unique?
It tends to be the coarser grind. I think that the Johnsonville's probably got that real, you know, if you're looking for a broad experience, and they're not the only one that does it this way, but I'm just saying as a comparison, I think that's pretty typical where it's that coarser grind. It tends to be bigger hit on the pork and the salt and the pepper flavoring, whereas more true German style or European style is going to be usually a finer grind and a little bit more of a balance of seasonings to the pork and fat flavoring.
So regardless of which kind we choose, which brand, whether we make our own, if science generally tells us not to boil brats before grilling and we're going to do it anyway, what's the right way to do it?
If you're going to do it, I would say go more of a simmer rather than a hard boil. I did an article a couple of years ago where we tried that kind of a gentle simmer and then put it onto there, so that if you really want to do some of that cooking ahead of time because you want to speed up the grilling time process, maybe, which is really the big benefit of parboiling or simmering ahead of time, is that, you know, you're kind of partially cooking it, so you're really cutting down the amount of time you need to have those brats on the grill. I guess that's what I would do. We did have an article. I think there's a link to the story. If you find our story, there's a link to that previous article where we did this kind of simmering thing, and that's got all the steps and ingredients and what we did. And actually, we did a little test to see if their style of beer made a difference, and did kind of a very unscientific taste test at work about who liked what style of beer with it. And we actually found that porters and reds actually do a real nice job if you're going to use those for a beer bath or for simmering ahead of time. Actually imparted some really nice flavor.
Dan, we really appreciate you taking one for the team and figuring all of this out for us with your own taste test. Very much appreciated.
No problem. I'm here to serve the people.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Daniel Higgins talking to WPR host Keely Boltina. Dan is the food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in the northeastern part of the state. They talked about Dan's article about whether science supports parboiling brats. You can find the link over at WPR.org/Central Time. You can tell us about your brat grilling secret, your method. What do you do? Do you boil or toss them straight on the grill? If you boil, what do you use for the liquid? A little beer involved. What difference do you think it makes in the brat? After hearing about Dan's research, are you going to try something different? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and take a stand. I tend to pre-boil. Maybe I'll try it the other way next time around. Only time will tell. Every Friday on Central Time, we do a thing about food. Creatively, we call it Food Friday. It happens a lot that I'll take what I learned on Food Friday and put it to use over the weekend. And this weekend was no exception. On Friday, we talked about making pies, especially summer-themed pies, with our guest Christina Ward. We've got a few of her recipes up at WPR.org/Food Friday, a pie crust, a cherry pie, and a blueberry ricotta no-bake pie. I didn't make those particular recipes, but inspired by the conversation, I did make a pie, and I used two key pieces of advice from Christina. Step one, I had a frozen pie crust from the store in the freezer. That part was easy, but following Christina's advice, I pre-baked it for 10 or 15 minutes before putting the stuff in it. And step two, I had a bunch of peaches that they needed using. We bought one of those crates of peaches, you know, they sell sometimes. We froze a lot of them. We still had some out. Again, following Christina's advice, I simmered the cut-up peaches in some sugar for a little bit, removed the fruit, and then thickened the liquid by simmering it with some cornstarch to make a slurry. So then the fruit and the slurry go into the pie crust. And to top it off, and I think this is inspired by Christina, I made a crisp dough. Like if you're making apple crisp, I use that to top the pie. The verdict, awesome. The pie is almost gone. I'm sorry I can't share it with you. The two pieces of advice on the crust and the slurry made sure that the crust didn't get all soggy. Again, find those pie recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. And if you have used cooking advice from Food Friday, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.